Okay, so first off, you have to understand there's a Michigan order to these things. Fix up the coolers and all, pile everyone in the rides in caravan 3 or 4 hours up north to your favorite lake. I prefer Bass Lake. Arrive? Ronnie's cottage is closed up. Well, you don't care. Just unload next to the beach. See? There's that pile of wood we chopped up last year. Fine, you chopped last year. I supervise. Somebody get the tents out. Set those stones around the fire pits. Yeah, the kids can start a fire. They gotta learn sometime. That's a nice blaze. Kendra, there's no Wi-Fi out here. We gotta set a good example. Now, y'all leave that alone. Everything in the cooler is for adults. Jerry, spray everybody down with bug spray and keep the twins away from the water. Yes, Susie, you drunk. I will spike the punch for the ladies. You are welcome. Hot dogs and burgers are up. Good, ain't it? I hear you, baby. Marshmallows in that bag. But y'all gotta find your own sticks. And get sticks for the little kids. The sun blazes down behind the Michigan forest line. And like a beacon, instead of watching the sky, everyone's gaze switches to the fire. Throw on another log and another. Marshmallows all gone. Ooh, Jamal, you bought the good stuff. Put some more of that in here, please. Now I let the conversation fade. And at long last. So, who's gonna go first? WNYC Studios, Snap Judgment proudly presents Campfire Tales. Amazing stories that can only be told around the fire. My name is Glenn Washington. You have to walk at least 10 paces away from camp to pee because you're listening. The Snap Judgment. Now then, for our first campfire tale story, here's the setup. Three college women go camping in New Mexico to relax. But it's not going to be a relaxing type of trip. Snap judgment.
The original plan for the vacation was to take a long weekend to the Manby Hot Springs, right on the bank of the Rio Grande Gorge. We decided to set up camp before it got too dark. The springs were really quite hot and it was very pleasant. Each one of the pools had a few people already in there. And as we got in, more and more people started leaving until we we're pretty much the only ones in there. There was one other person, a man who was down there with his dog. He looked like a mountaineer. He was wearing a long brownish gray coat and some hefty boots. We were in the pool and not wearing many clothes at all, and I almost kind of got the feeling he was just waiting for us to get out. The look on his face was almost vacant, like he was asking questions but not really paying attention to the answers. The dog kept walking around and around the hot spring, but the dog was acting peculiar in the way that as it was walking around to each one of us, it would kind of rub up against us. It wouldn't be showing affection. It didn't feel like an affectionate, nuzzle. The man pulled like a bandana or handkerchief out of the inside of his coat, and with that, he rubbed the length of the dog's side, and then he put it back inside of his jacket, and he looked at us and he said, "See you later, girls." once he was out of earshot, my friend said that dog was trained to pick up our scent. My mind was saying he's planning on coming back. We have our tent here. It's clear that we're spending the night. There's one trail out of here that leads to our car, which is now an almost empty parking lot. Like, there was nowhere we could go. Either he was going to be up there waiting for us if we left, or he was going to come back down at some point in the night. And panic was starting to set in. I was going through my bag to put on my warm clothes, and I grabbed the knife. At that moment, one of us noticed a beam from a flashlight was bouncing back down the trail. And we really just looked at each other, didn't say a word, and all three of us just started running. The Rio Grande Gorge is 90 miles, and there's no crossing of the river. There's no bridges, there's no foot crossings, there's no places where you can jump across rocks or anything. So we started climbing up the side of the bank walls. This is really dangerous terrain. My hands are just digging into cactus needles and pulling on any type of shrub or branch I can grab onto. Felt like we got up the side of that mountain with unbelievable speed. My two friends were scared and anxious, and I also was. And so I said, it's really good that we just did that. We're here. It's okay. We just need to rest, catch our breath. Right when I was doing that, we heard the dog barking. We looked in the direction of the dog barking, and we saw the flashlight beam coming towards us. We just took off running. It was in the middle of the national forest land, and we could see some lights from the city in the very, very far distance. It looked like it was a house. Somebody said that would be the help that we could get. So we just started running to the light. Going up and down these hills, I would just sprint up to the top of the hill, and then I would just roll down to the bottom. It felt like a quicker way to get to the bottom of the hill. I just felt like rubber. Very, very limp rubber in all of my limbs. My heart was pumping. My lungs just felt like they were bleeding. And my breath, it just burnt every breath. Incredibly, incredibly exhausting. I turn around and, you know, sometimes I'd see a flashlight, sometimes I wouldn't, but I could always hear that dog barking. It just was a consistent bark that never really seemed to get any closer. And it began to feel like my heartbeat. The dog still had our scent wherever we would go. So I had my pocket knife in my breast pocket, and I just kept thinking the dog would be the first thing to get to me. All I could think is I would just take my pocket knife and I would just stab the dog in its eyeball. I was thinking to myself, if the man caught up, my option would be to do the same to him, to slit his throat. You know, in movies, when people, they're running or they're being chased or they're in these life-threatening situations, and they just stop because they're exhausted. I always thought that was ridiculous. I always thought that when you're in that situation, you will always have reserves, that there will always be something more in you and more in me to push me through and survive. And I remember thinking that and be like, but I was wrong. It's really, really hard to keep going. It was probably a good hill or two behind my other friends who were moving a lot quicker than I was. And my good friend and roommate, she would look back and very frantically and desperately, you know, whisper and encourage me on and say, you know, keep, you know, you can keep going, like, we just need to keep running.
Get up, you can do it.
I didn't think I was going to live. I pulled my friend back to have her give my goodbyes. I said, tell my parents and my brothers that I love them. She said, you can tell them yourself. It's going to be fine. We just need to keep running. You're going to be fine. We're just going to keep running. And that's when she grabbed onto my arm. And for most of the rest of the run, she was either holding my hand, holding my arm, or really close to me. We did get there, and the three of us were all just sobbing in exhaustion and fear. We were pounding on the door, and the owners came down. They asked what we needed. They got us water. We were just trying to process what had just happened. While we were doing that, the man paused and was staring out the window. He closed the curtains. He said, everyone, like, get down on the ground. He told us that when he had looked out the window, he had seen a car that had its high beams on that just was pretty erratically just driving in circles and driving, backing up, moving forward in all directions with the high beams on. There was somebody out there who was looking for something. He said, call the police, like right now, and the three of you tell me exactly what just happened out there. The next morning, one policeman picked us up and drove us to where we left the car. And then he walked down with us down the switchback trail to where our tent was. Circling the tent was a set of male boot prints. At that point in time, I didn't camp for a while. I didn't want to hike for a while. I had fear by myself. I had fear with female friends. You know, now this is ruining my relationship with the wilderness. A close friend of mine suggested that I talk with the tarot card reader to get a different perspective. I was open-minded, but with a healthy amount of skepticism. We just had our own quiet place at this park along the creek. I was really holding my cards close to my chest and really not exposing too much. And so when she, out of the blue, said New Mexico, that really was the shift. I told her a short version of the story, my experience of it. And she said, if the dog wanted to reach you, it would have. But what it did instead was warn you about the man and keep you on the go and keep you alert to what you needed to do to stay safe. And I remember first going, well, I don't know. I don't really. But then I sat with that and I thought about it, and you know, the dog at any point could have caught up with me. There's no doubt about it. There's no way that dog, you know, was slower than I was. It could have caught up with me, but it never did. It was something that I think I had subconsciously acknowledged, you know, like I just never, it was the one piece I could never understand. Why did the dog never catch up?
Special thanks to Bree O'Kane for sharing her amazing story with Snap. Sound designed by Leon Morimoto, and that piece was produced by Liz Mack. Listening to the Snap Judgment Campfire Tales Special. And This is the season of the undead, the season we here at Snap are celebrating with Spooked Week, releasing 3 podcast-only Snap Judgment episodes, including The Hounds of Hell, Welcome to the Dollhouse, and Sight Unseen, all part of our countdown to the brand new Spooked 7, our most frightening episode ever, and it drops right here next week. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Now, Snap Judgment, the Campfire Tales episode continues with the strangest breakup story you've ever heard. Stay tuned. Back to Snap Judgment, Campfire Tales. We're sitting in front of the fire telling stories from the dark, and everyone knows that in the movies, what you do is you get some young, attractive people, lock them in a house or a lodge, maybe a resort, play up the sexual tension, keep the atmosphere thick, dim the lights, and then release the evil spirit. Watch the terror begin. That's how it works in the movies, but what about real life? You see, Mark, Debbie, Christy, and some of their friends were all together one night back in the 80s when suddenly... Well, Mark, why don't you tell the story?
The party really wasn't going anywhere.
It was a combination birthday party and going away party.
The only two people I know there are my friend Christy and our friend Deborah.
Christy and I have been good friends since high school. She has been one of my best friends for years. The party was in an old craftsman's house in Hollywood. Just so you know, I have a very bad memory and I don't remember very much, but I do remember very clearly a lot of this event.
The party was a hodgepodge of various individuals.
My girlfriend Becky was one of my roommates. Becky's boyfriend, Mike, he was a Malibu sheriff. Then there was Mark, the Frenchman. And my girlfriend Debbie. Then my boyfriend Danny, and he was the rocker.
In France, when we had a party, the idea was drink as much as you can, as fast as you can, and then put on James Brown's Sex Machine. Unfortunately, there was no James Brown available that night, so we had to think of something else. And I started to wander off into the dining area, and there was a huge oak table. And in the back, there was an armoire and a bunch of crystal glasses. And an idea popped in my head, and I thought, hey, there's nothing else going on here tonight. Why don't we do a seance? A long time ago, in my native country of France, there was no toy store where you would find a Ouija board. So we would line up Scrabble letters and cut up a piece of paper that would say yes and one that would say no, and basically improvise a Ouija board. We would turn a glass upside down, we'd put our fingers on top of the glass, and then you'd concentrate real hard.
It kind of just struck a chord that it would be something fun and different to do.
I kind of thought, whatever, we'll do it. I think in high school, maybe we tried it a couple times, but nothing really ever happened, so I didn't take it seriously and didn't really think anything of it.
I mean, I'm a spiritualist, like I believe in God, but I don't believe in Ouija boards. I wasn't taking it seriously. I didn't believe in that type of thing at all. So we lit some candles and turned on some, you know, Enya, and just kind of played around.
We cut out a bunch of letters, you know, to create the alphabet, put them around the table in a circle. There was a piece of paper that said yes and a piece of paper that said no. And we took a crystal glass with a stem and turned it upside down and put it in the middle. You know, everybody quiet down and closed their eyes, and I don't know if we are the antennas. I believe we are. And I believe that the glass ultimately is just a vessel and it allows psychic energy to concentrate at the center of it. For those of us who had their fingers on the glass, and I think at the time it was Christy, Deborah, me, and someone else, we started to feel, after a very short amount of time, actually it was uncanny how quickly it started. We started to feel that very familiar little tug.
It was a little bit thrilling, like, ooh, what is this? I remember my hair kind of raising up, thinking, what could this be?
You have the sensation that something is connecting with the glass and then trying to find its bearings. It's very distinctive.
And then after a while, it started kind of getting a flow and a rhythm, and it started kind of moving in an eight, like a shape of an eight, and back and forth, and it was very rhythmic, but it was flowing and very smooth suddenly.
Of course, the skeptics immediately thought, you're moving the glass. And I would say, no, I'm not moving the glass. And a good way to take care of the skeptics is to command the glass to do geometric forms. For example, I would tell the glass to spin in a circle. You tell the glass to go faster and faster and faster. And let me tell you, that thing flies. It's so fast. You cannot coordinate four people that don't know each other, have not rehearsed this, and get a glass to move this fast. It's impossible. At that point, everybody went, huh, what's going on? Now that it was clear that something was moving the glass other than ourselves, one of us asked, who's here?
And started going back and forth to the letter K-I-K-I, or K-E-K-E. I can't remember how it spelled it.
And everybody asked, who's Kiki? And Christy, who was at the head of the table in front of me, just froze. I hadn't ever seen her like that. And she looked down at the table and she said, I know who's here.
I knew it was Brian. Brian had been my boyfriend for about 2.5 years, and he passed after committing suicide. It spelled out K-E-K-E, which is Kiki, which was my nickname that Brian called me just in private. That threw me for a huge loop. That is something that I don't understand to this day. Brian was my first love. I used to think about him every day. I still have not been able to look at pictures of him, but I can still see his face in my head. He was very good looking, had an amazing smile. He kept a tan better than anybody that I ever seen. Brian was a very lonely, sad person, but most people wouldn't realize that when they met him. When he would walk into a room, everybody was drawn to him, and he was really funny, and he meant the world to me.
I think she was stunned. I think she was pretty shaken up. And I think she, you know, probably quite emotional about it because of the way things had ended.
Brian tried to commit suicide several times, and they put him in a little hospital. And then Christmas came, and I wasn't there, and I wasn't able to speak to him while he was in the suicide watch hospital. But I did find out that he got a belt and wrapped it around his neck and hung himself. A horrible way to die. And he was supposedly under supervision, and they were watching him, and somebody dropped the ball.
Are you in heaven? The glass answered, no. "Are you in hell?" And the glass answered, "No."
We asked him if he was in a place kind of somewhere in between. He said yes. And then Becky asked how long he was going to be there. And he said 27, which is the age he was when he killed himself.
I find myself, like, sometimes, like, I'll get, like, a little tear in my eye, like when I was talking to you. And then I just wipe it away and it goes away. It dries away.
Christy went to leave to go to the bathroom, and then it stopped moving. We asked the spirit, "Where'd you go? Did you go with Christy to the bathroom?" And it said, "Yes." And we asked him, "Okay, if you were there with her, what color underwear was she wearing?" And it spelled out, well, it misspelled it, but it said W-I-T-E, white. And sure enough, she was wearing white knickers.
Now, just behind Christy was another guest at the party who was her current boyfriend.
This kind of like glam rock guy sitting around the table, being really cool, not believing any of it.
I mean, what the hell? The ex is showing up uninvited at the birthday party and is getting all the attention. So he started to say, "This is bull." And the glass immediately starts to move without having been asked a question. "This is unusual." And spelled "you." At which point, Christy's boyfriend replied, "you."
And the cursor started spelling out his name, D-A-N-I, and then F-U. And it kept going back and forth, D-A-N-I-F-U. You know, you can fill in the blanks, but Danny got very upset.
Now, what's interesting here is that when you have to say something like, "mother," and you're speaking through a crystal glass as a spiritual entity, it takes a long time to spell M-O, etc., etc.
Danny was getting really upset, and sounds so silly. The Ouija board was getting really upset, which appears to have been Brian picking a fight, if you will, with Danny, my current boyfriend. It was very disturbing.
This is surreal. These two are having a cockfight in two different dimensions.
Danny was very hot-headed and very upset and ended up walking out.
My poor friend Christy was completely devastated. Meanwhile, the glass repeated several times, "I love you," and then, "I'm sorry."
I was just so almost frozen, just paralyzed inside my own head, thinking all these thoughts, you know, is this really him? Why did he die? How come nobody could help him? How much I missed him.
I think that because it was her birthday, we didn't really want to continue. So we said goodbye. And I remember my friend Deborah and I drove back to my house and didn't say a word on the way back.
Ever since that night, I have completely believed. I mean, to me, this was the most proof that there is something out there more than what we can see and what we know. And it's definitely changed the way I see things. And I am the biggest skeptic. I wouldn't believe this story if I weren't there. And I'm sure many people won't believe me, but it happened. And
I feel like he just needed to be heard again. You know, I know this sounds crazy, but I believe he was talking to us. Me.
I think the beauty of his story is not that it is a ghost story, is that it's a love story. And that someone was able to reach beyond the divide and tell someone, for the last time, "I love you." Even Romeo and Juliet didn't get that.
Big thanks to everyone who shared their story with Snap. Original score and sound design by Renzo Goriel.
That piece was produced by Bob Carlson for the amazing unfictional podcast from KCRW Santa Monica. Subscribe to them for more stories. We'll have a link to their website at snapjudgment.org. Now, I have a dear friend. His name is Chandra Shivakumar. And this story and this trouble began in Sri Lanka. Snap Judgment.
This happened in Sri Lanka, a place called Pategama, which was our family's tea estate up in the mountains. My aunt and my uncle managed it, basically. And one day she was totally fine, you know, running around up there in the mountains. And the next day she woke up and she could not move. She was paralyzed from the neck down.
Paralyzed?
Paralyzed. She couldn't move her limbs and they had no idea why. About half an hour after she woke up, she had trouble breathing. My uncle had to throw her in the car. They flew down these crazy windy roads down through the mountain and went to Colombo, the capital city, and they went straight to a hospital where she was in the ICU right away.
Why was she paralyzed?
Well, they couldn't tell. They had no idea. And finally, after 3 months, they said, look, we have no idea what to do. We don't know what to tell you. But there's this Sri Lankan priest. He's a Catholic priest. He might have some answers for you. Our folks are Hindu.
But they decided, why? Why are they going to this priest?
He had a reputation of being able to find answers where no one else could. He told my uncle later on that one day he was just a regular old Catholic priest and running mass. And the next day he had some terrible gift from God, he said, that allowed him to see evil. So my uncle said, all right, we don't have any other choice. My uncle went and found him. Yeah, he walked to the ICU with my uncle, who is he was a very practical fellow and not totally given to the belief in the occult, like a lot of my relatives, or even myself for that matter. So he was a little skeptical, but he walked in with this man and the man just said, I see evil. Evil has been done here. And he was so adamant about it that my uncle had to listen to him and then proceeded to follow his direction.
What were his directions?
He said, look, you and I have to get up back to the tea estate right away. So my uncle put him in the car and they drove back 4 hours.
For what was he looking for?
Well, the source of the evil. He said basically my aunt had been cursed. By the time they got there, it was about midnight. The priest said, look, you and I, we have to walk around the grounds until I can find this. So he spent an hour walking through the lawn and through every single room in the house. It was a big, big, beautiful estate house. And he got to their bedroom and he looked out the window and he said, there, I see the curse. And my uncle looked out and he said, I don't see anything. What are you talking about? He's like, I see it. It is right there. It's there in the corner of the house. And my uncle said, well, what are we supposed to do now? He's like, go find some men, get some shovels, and meet me down there on the corner. So he rounded up a few of the workers who were there, and the man said, well, start digging.
Right here, he knew exactly where to dig.
Yeah, he said he could see it. He could see a glow, an evil glow, emanating from underground. And they dug for about half an hour, and then his shovel hit this little metal container. He heard this clang, so he stopped, and the priest said, okay, hold on. And he looked into this little hole and he said, yeah, it's right there. Please bring that up. My uncle jumped into this little hole that he had dug. There was a little tin box. And the priest said, have you ever seen this before? He said, no. And he said, did you put this here? My uncle said, no, I have no idea what this is. So the priest said, okay, good. He opened up this tin box.
What's inside? What's inside? What's inside? What's inside?
And inside this little tin box lay this little voodoo doll. It was made out of mud and clay. And it was wrapped in some kind of cloth. It was in the shape of a human, a little body. And in this little mud figurine were some needles. Needles in the ankles, needles in the wrists, and one needle right in the throat. And like I'd said before, upon entering the ICU, she'd had to get a tracheotomy because she couldn't breathe. My uncle was pretty excited and really nervous and a little scared, actually really scared, he told me. And the priest said, I need to replenish my energies. And he shut the little tin box and he said, look, go find as much liquor as you can. They got all the whiskey they could collect. They went upstairs back to the bedroom. And this priest said, all right, you and I are going to drink right now for the next half hour. And these guys finished off a few bottles of whiskey.
A few bottles?
I think it was like, yeah, two bottles of whiskey they finished off, polished off. Uncle said that was the drunkest he's ever gotten in his life. And he thought, now that we've discovered the voodoo doll, we can get drunk and sleep and head back in the morning. But instead, the priest said, go get your keys. We're going for a ride. We have to take this doll to the ocean right away. My uncle said, there's no way we should not do this. This is a suicide trip. And the priest said, I'm really sorry, but, you know, we have to.
And this is something that Mothers Against Drunk Driving would not be pleased about in the slightest.
Yeah, this was some serious drunk driving.
And this is in the middle of the night, in the middle of through a jungle area?
This is in the middle of nowhere. I mean, this is 4 hours up a steep incline, not paved. And my uncle said, there's no way that we should have survived that trip with all the boulders and trees and ruts and bison and buffalo roaming through, jackals and Komodo dragons and cobras and tigers. Well, maybe no tigers. And all sorts of crazy monsters lurking in those jungles back in the day.
They make it through.
They made it through. They got to the ocean. The priest said, all right, get out of the car. And they stumbled their way to the ocean, to the beach. And he took the little voodoo doll out of the tin box and he gave it to my uncle and he said, throw it as far as you can. So my uncle took it and just threw it off right into the ocean waves and he saw the thing disintegrate. And then the priest said, all right, let's go to the hospital. So they got back in the car and they drove right to the hospital to see my aunt. The doctors came to my uncle and said, I don't know what just happened, but this past few hours, something has occurred. And miraculously, somehow or other, my aunt said, hey, guess what? In the past hour, I'm able to move. There's more feeling in my toes and my fingers. And my uncle said, I have no idea what happened or what to believe, but something crazy happened that night, thanks to this priest.
What did your uncle owe the priest? What did he give the priest in return?
You know, I don't think he gave him anything, actually. The priest said, this is my duty to humanity. This is a gift from God. You know, he said it's also a curse.
But
he
said, curse, why?
Well, because he has this ability now to feel and see and sense evil wherever he goes. So I imagine it wasn't such a pleasant experience for him.
Everywhere he went, he saw the bad stuff.
Yeah, I guess I think it actually, he saw a little too much of it.
Why?
Well, I asked my uncle what happened to this guy. You know, I thought maybe I could go track him down. But my uncle said he's now serving a life sentence for the murder of his wife.
He murdered his wife.
He poisoned her to death, yeah.
He has a wife as a priest. Why would he poison his wife?
I'm not sure. It was shocking. And my uncle basically said that the word on the island was this man had stared into the abyss a little too much and it had started to stare back. And he had fought off all this evil for so long and it had started to infuse his soul. You know, he started doing bad, evil things himself.
Thank you, Chandra, for letting us know what you know. The original score and sound design was by Renzo Gorio. When we return, Snap Judgment comes face to face with pure evil. Be afraid. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from WNYC. My name is Glenn Washington, and you're listening to Campfire Tales. See, when I was a kid, during the summers, I sometimes spent the weekend at my buddy Tommy's house. We went to the same church and he had a pool, right? He also had a sister. Cute, kind of shy. We sat down to dinner and there was an empty seat, so I tried to act all innocent. Where's Jenny? Oh, Jenny's fine, Mrs. Jones told me. Just having one of her spells. Don't you worry none about her. See, in my church, going to the doctor wasn't allowed. The apostle said the Lord had spilled his blood and was all the doctor we needed. We just had to pray for healing. Jesus would answer in his good time, but if things got serious, we were supposed to call the minister for an anointing. And the crazy thing is, I'm the one who said it. Shouldn't we call the pastor? Tommy kicked me under the table. Miss James looked hard at Mr. James. The chicken passed from one person to the other. Yes, I think we should. In fact, we should have called a long time ago.
Your pastor can't come over here every time that girl has a spell, woman. That's not what it's for.
Let the pastor say what it's for. That's not our place. Tommy kicked me again. It hurt.
Fine. Go on ahead. Call and interrupt the pastor's nice dinner just because Jenny's having one of her spells. Call him.
She did. A half hour later, pastor knocked on the door. Carl? Betty, hello, boys.
Carl, what's wrong with your little girl?
Well, it's nothing, really. She just sometimes gets a shaking is all. She just shakes fit to bug all, and then she don't shake, and she's fine. Lots of people go through phases like that. Betty's making these mountains out of molehills. Pastor, can I get you some coffee? Betty, get the pastor some coffee.
The pastor took a piece of white cloth out of his vest pocket and a small vial of olive oil. He unfolded the cloth and smeared a little of the oil into it. We were both, me and Tommy, trying to disappear towards the basement when he stopped us. Boys, the Lord's healing depends on the prayers of the faithful, so I'm going to need you to stay and pray with me. I knew Tommy would have kicked me again, but I was standing too far away. Jenny came down the stairs then, wearing pink and blue pajamas, hair wild, eyes red. She looked surprised to see me, and I knew I wasn't supposed to be there. I wasn't supposed to see her like that, and I wanted to go home and leave these people to their trial. You could see it plain as day, her right arm twitching, sometimes her shoulder or her leg. Miss James started to cry.
Baby, what is wrong with your arm? Why is your arm moving like that? Pastor, why is her arm moving like that?
That's not for me to know, Betty. We're just going to put this in the Lord's hands with the Lord's anointing. He dabbed some more oil on the cloth and reached down to touch Jenny's head, and she growled. A low, steamy, throaty growl that shouldn't have come out of a girl's throat. Pastor snatched his hand back like he'd been bitten. Jenny's face tightened. Don't touch me.
Jenny, you do not speak to the pastor like that.
It's not her, Betty. It's not her.
What do you mean?
I'm gonna need everybody to pray with me now. Get thee from this child, demon! The growling grew louder, more angry.
Pastor, what's happening? What are you doing? What are you doing to my baby?
This child is possessed of an evil spirit, and I mean to send it back to the devil.
She's just a baby.
Jenny fell to the floor, both of her arms flailing.
Ow, demon!
Pastor put the oil on her forehead, and she screamed as if it burned fire.
In the name of the King of Holiness and the name of the Father that brought light into this world, I command you out, demon, out! Out of this child!
A rank stench as Jenny voided herself on the floor.
For thine is the kingdom and the glory and the power.
Jenny's eyes rolled back into her head. Her arms stopped spasming. Her eyes still white. She smiled.
Languid,
she spoke. This child is mine. Pastor broke open his vial of oil and dumped it on her head.
Ow! 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 This is a sanctified child, and you will not have her, demon. By the blood, the blood, the blood, the blood, the blood, the blood of he who has died for us, you will not have her.
Jenny stretched tight, like she was being pulled and then sprung back into a fetal position.
Mama! Mama! Mama's right here. Darling, Mama's right here. Everything's going to be all right. Isn't that, Pastor? Tell her everything's going to be all right. Pastor didn't say anything. He was breathing heavy pain, looking around the room. Miss Jones led Jenny upstairs. Mr. Jones followed him. Thank you so much for that, Pastor. Thank you. Pastor seemed unsteady as he departed the house. Don't stop praying, boys. Do not stop praying. The floor was covered in excrement and fluid and shards of broken glass. Tommy got some buckets and towels. I grabbed a mop. We stayed silent, each of us in our own heads, until Tommy shouted at me, "What are you doing? Whoa, what are you doing? What? What?" Tommy pointed at my arm. I looked down. It was twitching.
You have only just now reached the beginning, for 'tis the season to push back the veil and chase those things that go bump in the night. The countdown to Spook 7 has already begun. With more amazing snap judgment, true life ghost stories than you can scream at. Tell everyone you know. Our biggest episode of the year. Get the podcast while you still dare. Snapjudgment.org. Do you want a taste? You want a little taste? Be afraid. And the show, electrifying audiences nationwide, is on tour. Snap Judgment Live. Listen when I tell you, this show is made of fire and magic. I can't wait for you to see it. We're calling it Twisted. And it features the Justice League of Twisted Storytellers, including Jamie DeWolf, Jen Colbert, the closer James Judd, and audience favorite Don Reed. Also, new to the Snap stage, but maybe the most twisted story of all, her name is Katie Leavitt. You've got to see it. New cities are being added all the time. Minneapolis, Detroit, Chicago, San Francisco, you are up next. Get tickets while you still can at snapjudgment.org. The shows will sell out. I'm telling you right now, snapjudgment.org. Snap was produced by the team that never sleeps alone in the woods. Would you please run away in horror from the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich, Pat Macedi Miller, Anna Matchstick Sussman, the Forest Ranger, Davey Kim, Joe, Safety First Rosenberg, Eliza, Pork and Bean Smith, Renzo, Vegans Can Camp Chew Gorio, Nancy Lopez is dubious, Leon Morimoto is studious, Lisa Egan is furious, Tail, the grooviest Akkad, Jasmine Aguilera simply doesn't rhyme. Remember, something wicked this way comes. Let the people know. 4 spooked episodes for your listening pleasure. Podcast only. Make a party of it. Turn on the lights. Run the water. Light the stage. Whatever it is you do. Light the sage. Whatever it is you do, do that. But do not listen alone. Now then, this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could go camping in the woods with your gang of friends with the one black dude. And the black dude could say, "Oh, I don't know. I've got a bad feeling about this." But you could ignore him. When the black dude doesn't show up after the midnight hike, you can just figure maybe he got lost. And then when the boogeyman comes and eats everybody up, it's your own fault because he gave you a 4-hour warning, and all that would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.